Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Dan Aronson, your host for Press One for Democracy, coming to you at our regularly scheduled time every Monday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, 10 p.m. on the East Coast. And as usual, we have our co-host, Debbie Lynn Mono, will be joining us as well. And we have a lively show for you, I think. I think this is a very interesting topic. And we're going to talk about what it means to you to be an American. All right. So if you think about back in the day when people first started emigrating en masse to this country, the stories were pretty much the same. You know, people would save up and send one person over, and they would kind of stake their claim and make some money, and then they would send back for other folks, and those folks would then come over, and then it would just build and build and build. But it wasn't about I'm just going to America to get rich for me, but it was really about I'm going to make a better life for myself, but also for those I love and care for. So the question is, now we're several hundred years down the road, and the question is, the people that have made it and made it big, have they forgotten that, or maybe that's just no longer important? And I'll tell you what, we've got a ton of callers already lined up, so I'm going to come and bring in 954, followed by 973 and 518, and so 954, I'm going to come right to you. Who do I have the pleasure of speaking with?
Hi, Neil from Fort Lauderdale. How are you doing?
Hi, Neil from Fort Lauderdale. Normally my home is Portland, Oregon, but I'm actually broadcasting from Tampa. For the second week, I'm actually in Florida. I'm on your side of the world enjoying some sunshine, so I appreciate you letting me share that.
No problem.
So, Neil, what does it mean to be an American to you? Do you have obligations to the greater society, or is this really just all about whatever I can grab, I'm going to get?
I'm very much about the great society. I'm very much about Social Security. I'm about corporations paying their fair share. I'm about Americans working together to make this country great for everyone.
Okay, so then have those that have made it and made it big, who are now doing things like funding super PACs and trying to their best to buy influence in Washington. Have they lost their way, or are they attempting to redefine what it means to be an American?
It's just endless amounts of plutocracy and corruption. You know, I mean, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And when you have people who, 25% of the corporations, all the loopholes and everything else, don't pay any taxes whatsoever. There's trillions and trillions of dollars offshore. You don't hear about that in the mainstream media. You don't hear about the trillions of dollars of corporate welfare that goes to oil companies and other corporations. That's our money. Meanwhile, they're telling us they have to go to Social Security and Medicare, and it's a farce. It's a fraud. This country is very well off. It's just that the money is redistributed in such a way that it's just pure plutocracy. And an uneducated voter is what a lot of these people want. They want people not to be collective thinkers, to be aware of what's going on. I mean, I believe that everyone – As a society, as a great society, we need to move together, and there should be good jobs, there should be respect for everyone. There shouldn't be this immense amount of poverty that we have in this country.
Well, I certainly agree with you. So let me phrase this question then this way: if you look at the U.S., at least the voting population, it really breaks out into almost three distinct groups. So there's the Republicans, there's the Democrats, who are split almost 50-50 and constantly at each other's throats. And then there's this other even greater amount of people, these $80 million voters that did not participate in the last election. So how do we successfully unify at least the majority of people in the United States and recapture that the vision that you're speaking of, the great society, or as Lincoln put it, this great experiment.
Well, I think one of the major things is that the media and everything else has made it where there's so many laws now that are so anti-voting. They're making it so difficult to vote that a lot of people get just very, very turned off by the whole process. They make it harder and harder to be part, to have your voice into the American dream. I think that the media, they always seem to concentrate on stories that really don't really work in helping us achieve that dream. They're all owned by the same people that are trying to separate us in the first place. It's just basically trying to fool and make people be at each other's throats. Like the whole thing in Washington, it's all a game. I mean, they've always been against each other, but when it comes to plutocracy, when it comes to greed, they're all in line. You know, they serve the same masters. You know, the major power in this country is really the banks who are getting away with everything, and that's the real problem.
So I hear you. Again, total agreement. What's the solution? Because that's what I like to get to. How do we fix this?
I think that there's a lot of things you have to fix. You have to get more people. You have to get people aware of their rights, either through multimedia. You have to get people, solutions. You have to go door to door. You have to talk to people. This radio show, perfect example. It's like you're getting out there. You're talking to people. You're sharing ideas and ideals together. There's many things you can do with multimedia to get. I mean, there's a certain percentage that will never vote. They're just not interested. But in this country, we have a problem. We have a lot of people that just are very turned off. And hopefully, with all this multimedia, we can get more and more people involved.
Oh, no, those are great ideas. Any closing thoughts before I go to the next caller, Dale?
No, I just thank you, and I just believe in this country, and I believe that everyone should get a fair shake, and everybody should be represented. That's all.
No, I'm totally in agreement with that. So. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put you back on mute, but if you want to cycle back in and give an additional comment, all you have to do is hit 1 to get out of the queue and then 1 to get back in the queue anytime.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Neil.
Have a good day.
You too. So that was Neil from Fort Lauderdale. So we've got, let's see, what have we established? So we've established we've got to get money out of politics. Because it's skewing everything. We've got the media who's coming in and trying to jam us up as well and keep us at each other's throats. So lots of things to fix. Let's go to 973. Who are you and where are you calling from?
Hi, I'm Julie from West Milford, New Jersey.
Hi, Julie from West Milford. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good, good. Are you under a blanket of white this evening?
Oh, yes, very much so.
But nothing too terrible?
No.
Okay, good. New Jersey needs to be spared every once in a while from some of these things.
Well, we're strong. Jersey's strong.
Jersey strong, love it. So, so Julie, what does it mean to you to be an American?
Both my parents came over to this country. Both my parents, and my mother came here and not speaking a word of English, and she was very young at the time, and she had to learn on her own how to speak English. And I think it's like everything is catered to the people that are coming in. They don't, it seems like they don't want to learn the language. It's like everything you pick up, like a product or anything, it's like three different languages on it. I mean, honestly, my mom came to this country. She had 9 kids. And brought up 9 kids, 6 boys, 3 girls, worked. My dad, left, but she did it all on her own. And I just don't understand. I mean, she went for her citizenship and everything, and she didn't get anything for nothing. I mean, she worked for everything. Nothing was handed to her, you know. I think too many people come into this country and are given so much more than being a, you know, you're born here, you're an American, you vote and everything. And people, I just feel that people, the American people are not being taken care of.
Okay, so just kind of trying to summarize. So it's a matter of you come into the melting pot society, but you decide you're not going to melt and blend in.
Exactly. I mean, you go into a motor vehicle and you have to, the person behind the desk has to speak at least Spanish or, I mean, Spanish is our second language in this country. I mean, you go anywhere and in any of the, let's say, Social Security. I went in there, and I've been in there, and I listen, and there's someone speaking Haitian, there's someone speaking Spanish. You know, they have different languages. I just don't understand why they can't learn our language. I just don't understand that.
Well, that's very interesting. That's a very interesting comment. I've got a few ideas and questions I'd like to ask you, but at this point, Debbie Lynn Molina, my co-host, has something she'd like to jump in here with.
Okay.
Yeah, I just wanted to add in, and hi, everybody, by the way. I was listening to a program on our local public radio station last night, and I'm looking real quick to see what it was. I think it was called City Arts and Lectures, and it was on the air last night, Sunday night, and I'm going to post a link in the chat room as soon as I find it. And they were talking about the number of languages that are learned per country. They were actually talking about, like, which countries in the world are the richest. And so they were commenting about how, like, Norway is actually the richest per capita country in the world. And the average person in Norway knows 5 languages. And they went on down the list of the top countries in the world that have the wealthiest per capita populations. And they're all very multilingual. And the U.S. ranks down around 22nd. And, of course, we're very unilingual in our country, or sometimes bilingual because of the immigration issue. And how these countries that embrace multilingualism and actually teach it in the schools, where they have their native language, and then they teach the language of business, which does happen to be English usually, sometimes German, sometimes French. If you're in Europe, Chinese is becoming more and more prevalent.
Yes, very much so.
Very much so. But the countries that are embracing this multilingualism are the ones who are actually increasing their capacity to do business in the world, and therefore their population, the people in those countries, are doing better and are increasing their capacity to do business around the world, whereas as America seems to be clamping down and saying, no, everybody needs to know English, and we can only teach you in English, and it kind of inhibits. It's not that Spanish speakers shouldn't know English, but it's that English speakers should also know Spanish. So it seems like a double standard to me. And so it's not like we're embracing multilingualism. It's more like we're saying, you're other because you don't know English. And so I agree that people who come to this country need to speak English, but there's also not this embrace of multilingualism in our country. We're always like, no, you need to adapt to us, rather than, oh, we really love your culture. How do we communicate better with each other?
Well, I think I think it's a little bit too soft, because my mom, she learned how to speak English because either she was told just, you know, they didn't understand her, and she was told to leave the shop. She went into a cleaner's one time, and she was actually told to leave the shop because she was trying to pick up her, at that time, everything had to be pressed, sheets, everything. And she went to pick up her sheets, and she said, shits. And the guy got mad and threw her out.
Well, yeah, that I think is a little bit too intolerant. But let me ask you a question. And by the way, Linda, we're coming to you right after we're completed with Julie. But Julie, have you ever traveled to other countries? I'm just curious.
Just to Canada. To Canada and Bahamas.
Okay, I've had the very fortunate and good luck of being able to travel on business and have other people pick up my tab. So I've got to go a lot of other places in the world and do business. And I can tell you this: if you put the shoe on the other foot, you know, we are known a lot in especially in Europe as ugly Americans because everywhere we go, we speak English and we expect they just speak English, and they kind of feel. You know, it's like, well, you're not – they kind of – they express the same sentiments that you're expressing. They go, well, you're coming to my country. Can't you even get a phrase book knowledge, you know, or get out a little phrase book and even try to speak my language? Because they really get crazy. They love it when you do that. But they – I mean, you know, the thing is – and the it's almost like they think we're arrogant because, let's face it, the dollar for now, who knows how much longer, is the international standard of currency, right? And – we are the big business center, and so countries that have wanted to do more business, as Debbie Lynn pointed out, with America have made it a very a big point within their educational system to teach English. So it's almost like, yeah, I see it from where you're talking about, what you're talking about, but I also see it from their standpoint as well as like, oh, those arrogant Americans, they don't even want to try to speak my language. And the other question is this. So the kids, when they come here, get to go to school and learn English, right? Where do parents go to learn English? Where does an adult go who has just immigrated to this country to learn English?
Well, my mother learned it from the television, actually, and the neighbors. She actually taught it herself.
Well, what would you do? Should we have government-sponsored and paid-for classes for as part of, say, going for your citizenship? Where you're actually taught English?
Well, my mom had to take the citizenship, and I remember her trying to read the book of for her to become a citizen, and it was all in English. And
right. So, wouldn't it be great if she could have had somebody to help her to teach her English while she was doing that?
She knew already. She was, by that time, she was in this country long enough that she was speaking English. Might have been broken, but she was still speaking it. And she learned how to read, you know, to read it. And she passed it the first time.
Well, and God bless her, and that's awesome. And sometimes I think the people that are naturalized citizens seem to have a deeper love of the concept of democracy and the concept of what it means to be an American because they had to work so hard for it, whereas somebody was just born here. Well, you know, they just kind of take it for granted, right?
Oh, most definitely. I think
okay.
It is. I
think it's a great idea, but I think if we're going to demand people to speak English, we're going to make that a requisite – a prerequisite, then I think we need to turn around and afford them a better opportunity or a better option to learn English than just say, hey, watch television and pick it up.
Well, they have apps on phones that are free for downloads. And let me tell you, I've seen a lot of people with phones and, you know, it's an app. all you have to do is download it, and it comes right on, and it teaches you how to speak any language you want on it.
Well, that's very cool, and we should definitely be promoting that. Julie, it's been a pleasure. Any closing thoughts?
Just one thing about Social Security. I think going back to Eisenhower, everybody's been dipping into the kitty for Social Security, and nobody puts back. I don't understand that. Why is that done?
Because the people in Washington are crooks and thieves. I mean, that's the only answer, right? I mean, they are literally, you're right. You're absolutely right. When Social Security started, the funds, it was a separate fund. Then all of a sudden they went, oh, no, just throw it in the general fund. Well, once it does that, it gets lost in the wash, right? I mean, it's if you think about it, that's money laundering. If you were a gangster, that's how you'd launder money. And it's basically what the people in Washington did. They're money launderers. They laundered the Social Security money, and it came out, oh, we can spend it on wars and on bridges and on, you know, whatever. It's crazy.
Exactly.
Insane. It's criminal. It's criminal what they've done
to
Social Security. I agree. Let's throw them all in jail.
And not one president has, or Congress or whatever, has put the money back in. They take it out, which they say they borrow, but they don't put back in.
Wouldn't you like to have a bank that just keeps giving you money, and then you keep going back, and I know I owe you $10 billion, but here, give me another billion, and they go, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, because that's what the Federal Reserve does. But that's you're absolutely right. You're spot on. But obviously, if we're $14 trillion in debt, we certainly can't start putting money back into Social Security that we don't have, right? It's a big Ponzi scheme, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah, of course. What are you going to do? Say, oh, yeah, I put $6 trillion back in, and actually you didn't do it, you know?
Yeah, I agree with you. But that's a deficit reduction question, and it's a good one, and, you know, probably topic for a great show.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Hey, Julie, thank you for calling, and it's always a pleasure to hear from you. Please, again, if you want to hit one and cycle out of the cube, if you want to comment in, jump in later, please just hit one again.
Okay.
All right. Going to Linda. Miss Simmons, how are you on this fine Cincinnati evening?
Linda?
It's not Linda. It's Laura. Yeah.
Laura.
Laura, you know, I'm going to bust out my co-host. She typed Linda on there, and I went, wait, no, Linda, it's Laura. I'm like, Debbie Linda, a little tight.
So sorry, Laura. So sorry. That was me. My fault.
We'll forgive you.
Thanks,
well, I don't know.
Honey.
Linda, will you forgive Debbie Lynn?
Well, you know, Dan, thinking about, I mean, to me, I can't imagine what it would be like to be a rich person. But I think there was a time when rich people thought, you know, giving back was part of what rich people did. But now it's giving back to Africa. That's what you hear about a lot. You know, all the poverty in Africa. And it's like, I feel like the attitude is, and I've heard lots of people say this, especially in the medical field, there are still plenty of opportunities in America.
So do you agree with that statement? Well, first of all, I'd like to maybe go back to the top of the show, pretend this is the top of the show and make a disclaimer. There are plenty of very, very generous rich people out there. We know Will Rice, our very own Will Rice, and the patriotic millionaires. There's tons of corporations out there, Nike, big on the green and big on the giving back, Ben and Jerry's, phenomenal company, Russell Simmons Company out of New York. I mean, all of these people were actually out there and using social consciousness as a guide for their business instead of how to get rich. And they said, you know what, if we help enough people, we'll get what we need. So I don't want to think that we're warring against all rich people or trying to lump all rich people together, because there's a lot of generous ones. But your point is very well spoken and very well taken. My brother sent me a letter once, and it was just as I read it, I was like, this is crazy, this common sense. And he spoke to that exact thing. You know, we walk past a homeless person and we give them $1 and we feel good about ourselves. But how many people do we know, maybe within our own even families, that are hurting? And why aren't we reaching out to those people first?
Thank you. Amen.
Yeah.
Because it's politically correct to give to education. So, you know, whether these people honestly believe that or not, you know, I can get educated to where I know everything a human being can possibly know in the number of years that I live. But if I can't do anything with it, besides maybe teach it to other people, how do I eat? How do I put a roof over my head? How do I get medical care? My education isn't going to automatically grant those things to me. And if I pay $40,000 for an education and get a $10 an hour job, how am I supposed to pay back my student loans? By giving me 30 years to pay them back instead?
I hear you absolutely, and you know I saw something in the chats, and Chad Long has typed something in the chats, and he's absolutely right. By on a per capita basis, the middle class is the most giving of all classes, and I think that's because we get it, right? We live it. We've all been down. We've had our ups and downs, and we understand. And yeah, I mean, you know, that whole thing, give till it hurts. I mean, my wife, you know, she frets about every charitable donation we make, and she researches and everything, and she gives as much as we can, probably more than we should be giving. But you know what? It's what you do when you've lived that, right? When you've lived like Laura lives. And you get it, like, because I don't doubt that if tomorrow you won the lottery, you would do a lot of really good things with that money.
Well,
I just don't doubt it.
One of the things I do is help support more homeless shelters, because we have one small homeless shelter in Claremont County, and the women are sleeping on the floor so that the kids can have beds, and the men are getting turned away.
Yeah, it is horrible. So to me, the kind of things you're talking about, that's infrastructure, right? And that's what we know. There's been no serious spending on infrastructure of that nature. Not enough spent on education. Not enough, right? I mean, go back to Julie's point, right? If we want people to speak English, then gosh darn it, we better have classes at the local community center that are paid for by the government. Either local or federal, give them a place to go to learn it instead of saying you're on your own. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's great that Julie's mom figured it out from that. But let me tell you something. I was working with some people from Germany for a while, and I tried so hard to learn German. I just can't understand their sentence structure.
Yeah, you got me.
I mean, like, we would say the dog jumped over the fence, and they would say jumped over the fence the dog, or something in that kind of order. I mean, their order is totally different than ours.
Absolutely. My son actually took Latin in high school, and when I went in to meet with his teacher at orientation day, he had a doll of Yoda, the Star Wars, you know, character, and I looked at that doll and I said, does Yoda speak with Latin constructed sentences? And he goes, you're the first person that's ever got that from that doll. So that weird, you know, how I can't do Yoda speak, but you know, great is the force with you. You know, the weird sentence structure, right? It's Latin. That's how you would do it if it was in Latin. But you know what, Laura, I don't think that, you know, and all the studies show this, you know, hands down. I mean, you don't start trying to learn a language when you're 40 or 50 or 60. You've got to learn it when you're young. And the younger, the better.
If people who grew up in multilingual neighborhoods or homes, they have no problem. They pick it up and boom. I mean, if you grew up in a neighborhood with four or five different languages and you played with all the neighborhood kids, like I remembered used to doing that. And, those kids have no trouble, yeah. And, but I think the thing is I can't imagine being rich, even though growing up I did know some rich people in Philadelphia. And some of those were some of the kindest people. But I'm not talking about, most people consider rich if you make a couple hundred thousand. Yeah, that's rich to them because they're making 20 or 30,000. Now, when I'm talking rich, I'm talking about, you know, people like Mitt Romney. People that never have to work another day in their lives if they don't want to.
Right. No, I agree with you. And there's really two things at play here, right? So there's rich individuals, but then there is the rich corporations, the wealthy corporations that have gotten so fat. Corporate profits have done nothing but skyrocket, even through the crash of 08. They did a little hiccup for 9 months. For three quarters, they were down. They shot right back up. They've been going up and up and up and up. And, you know, where are the jobs, Mr. Job Creators, right? Where is paying your people a decent wage? Walmart's the biggest company, Fortune 1, biggest company in the world, yet 80% of their people are on some kind of assistance. Why can't you find a way to – why didn't you pay these people? I think it was forgive me if I get this one wrong. The Papa John's pizza guy said he'd have to charge like 14 cents more per pizza, and then he could give all of his people health insurance, and he said, no, that would hurt his business.
Don't even get me started on this guy who used Peyton Manning, my Denver Broncos quarterback, to do his advertising.
I
honestly think that a lot of people believe whatever is shoved in their face. I mean, I honestly do. You're talking about a smaller businessman. But I think some of these people, like some of these CEOs, Their brains are out there. Their minds are out there. They're out there in the clouds. They don't live in the world we live in. They don't have the kind of experience. They're not bombarded with the kinds of things we are. Because we have become a culture of we want to live in a neighborhood with a class of people who are like us. You know what the real estate says? Never buy the biggest house on the block. You know why?
No.
Never buy the biggest house, never buy the nicest house. Because it will never be worth as much as if you put it in a nicer neighborhood with other big homes.
You lost me there, Laura.
You've never heard that about real estate? Oh, Dan, don't you have any realtor friends?
I own a house in Marietta, Georgia, that I'm upside down, and like everybody else is in Marietta, Georgia. So I will say that I am not that familiar with the real estate market.
Oh, well, I'm not talking about now. I'm talking about before all that happened.
Okay.
Yeah. You talk to any realtor, they will tell you, do not buy the nicest house or the biggest house on the block. You want the houses to be relatively the same because really the value of the homes is based on the neighborhood, not the particular house.
Oh, yeah. I see what you're saying. Okay.
I don't know if this is true of everywhere, but I know in Cincinnati, it's all about the school system. The better the school system, the more expensive the house.
Right. Yet, it seems like, I don't know how it is in Cincinnati, but it's almost everywhere I've lived. Every time somebody's wanted to raise local taxes to pay for additional funding for schools, they always voted down.
Yeah. Well,
and
we've gotten to be a suspicious culture. And to be honest with you, I resented Target bragging about how much money they gave to schools when they were paying me $7 an hour.
And you know what? They could afford to do both. They could afford to pay, give the money to the schools and pay you a better wage. There's no doubt.
So, you know, I think it's just that your mind is kind of has a tendency to be set on whatever's going on in your life. And if all you're exposed to is cell phones and business meetings with people with $2,000 suits and flying around the country and eating nice meals and wine and dining potential clients and stuff, that's where your brain's going to be. Your brain's not going to be on what's happening with my employees. You know what I'm saying? We get like tunnel vision. That makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it's you know, the saying is think globally but act locally. And sometimes I think act locally to most people is it's just whatever's in my best interest.
And they talk a good game
about being charitable. And they talk a good game about giving back, but they don't. In the end, they especially when they go in to vote, it's all about their pocketbook, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes giving back is about your pocketbook, too. It's about how do I look to everyone else.
I totally agree, Laura.
Without being charitable. You can do it for selfish reasons.
Absolutely. As long as it comes out good, all good in the end, right? I mean, you know, Ted Turner years and years ago came out and said, I'm giving $1 billion to charity. And when they analyzed it, the way that financially he was putting the whole thing together, he was actually going to virtually break even on it because of all the different tax breaks. Who cares? The guy gave $1 billion to charity, you know?
Yeah, there's things like that that people like you and me don't often find out about.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Laura, always a pleasure.
Yeah.
And thanks for calling in. And, of course, like everybody else, if you want to hit one and cycle out and cycle back in, we'll certainly love to talk to you.
Thanks, Dan. I want to hear what other people have to say.
Thank you, as do I. And which actually reminds me, we are actually looking for some additional callers at this present time to dial in. And you just dial 646-929-2495, and when you get in, hit 1 to press 1 for democracy. That's your chance to get into the queue and tell us what you think it's being an American is about. Have the rich forgot? Are they just now just stockpiling their own money and their own wealth, building their giant houses and gated communities, sending their kids to private school, and basically, you know, seceding from the society? And it's not giving back. Certainly they don't seem to be doing a good job of creating jobs, that's for sure. But corporate profits still skyrocket. So, again, that number is 646-929-2495. Also, at this point, I'd like to give a shout out to the coffee party as a whole. Of course, we are totally volunteer based, and we fund all of our shows, like Press One for Democracy and all the other radio shows and everything else we do. It's all funded by memberships. So if you're not a member but you like what we're doing, please go to www.coffeepartyusa.com and click on the join link, and it will take you down. You can join for a couple of dollars a month. You can join for a one-time annual fee, or you can be an angel, as Janine always says. We're still looking for our first angel. If you want to throw 10 grand our way, we'll be happy to take it, run with it, and do what we do. And what do we do? What is Coffee Party about, of course? We're about civil, fact-based conversations, and we are about transpartisanness, which means we invite everybody with every viewpoint. Give them a voice, give them a place where they can come and have that discussion. Again, civil and fact-based. And again, the part I really like and the thing that I'm constantly pushing on my show is it's just not, shouldn't just be a place to come and complain. You know, boy, we could complain from, we could fill 15, 20 hours a day complaining, right? But let's find solutions. Let's sit down with everybody and invite them to the table. Let's find solutions. So you can do that here, roundtable that here. You can also, of course, find that on every Tuesday night. Boy, I don't know. I'm stuttering tonight. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's all this heat in Florida I'm not used to. But
I think it's the humidity.
Maybe that, yeah. It's not the heat,
heat.
It's the humidity.
You just created a new word, too, with transpartisanness.
Transpartisanness. Yeah. Okay. I like it. I mean, you type transpartisan into a Microsoft Office document, and it says that's not a real word. I guess we might as well make up additional words as well. But on Tuesday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern time, I'm sorry, 8 p.m. Eastern time, 5 p.m. Pacific time, we have the Middle Ground with Eric Beiler, Coffee Party co-founder, and Michael Charney, Coffee Party self-proclaimed moderate Republican and author. Great show. Perfect example of transpartisanness. As long as I made it up, I might as well keep using it, right?
I love it.
Then actually, if I copyright it, then I'd have to pay myself every time I use it. Can I get rich doing that? No, I don't think that'll work. And on Thursdays, Thursday afternoons at 12 p.m. Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern time, we have Lunch with Loudon, hosted by Ginny Loudon, and also co-hosted by our lovely co-host, Debbie Lynn Molyneux. And then on Saturday mornings, Pacific time, 10 a.m. Pacific, 12 Central, and 1 p.m. on the Eastern on the East Coast, we have Egberto Willis doing Politics Done Right, a great roundtable show where Egberto will often have 6-7 microphones open, and a nice civil conversation ensues that sometimes gets a little bit out of hand, but Egberto's just a real expert at being able to handle all of those open mics, and it's a great 2 hours and of fun conversation. And I'll tell you, the callers, as they are in all the shows, great points, very intellectual, very informed. I learned a ton by listening to Coffee Party Radio, and I hope you all get out of it as much as I do as well. It looks like Julie has cycled in again. So Julie from New Jersey, did you have something else you wanted to comment on?
Yes. Hi. How are you doing?
Hi.
This is Julie again. I just had another thing when Laura was talking about schooling. And also you brought up schooling about, you know, why should we pay more taxes into schooling and stuff like that. I remember when the lottery started in this country. And supposedly all the money that was supposed to go for the lottery was supposed to go for the schools, our schools. And, I mean, it's a lot of people play, you know, the Mega Millions and all this other stuff, scratch-offs, all these things. All this money, where is it going? I mean, okay, people do win. But a lot of people lose. Where is this money going? It's supposed to go for the schools, I thought.
Well, so different. Like I actually have fun experience because I spent 35 years in Chicago, my first 35 years, and then I spent 15 years in Georgia. And I can tell you this, lotteries weren't started for that purpose, but one of the unique functions or unique ways that they started marketing the lottery in Illinois was they said a full 50% of all monies collected by the lottery will go to schools. And it was going to go to set up these great education programs, scholarships, et cetera, and help fund kids going to college. And about four years later, the woman who was hired to run the Illinois lottery quit because she knew for a fact it was maybe more like 30%. And she immediately was snapped up by Georgia. Georgia has something called the Hope Scholarship. It's a beautiful thing. If you graduate with a C average or above from a Georgia high school, you get full tuition and books paid for by the state at any Georgia State College. And you know what that did? Not only did it allow people who wouldn't previously have been able to afford to go to school to go to college, but it made all of a sudden the admission standards shot up for all the Georgia schools. I mean, right now to get into the University of Georgia, you need like a 3.85 average GPA. You need to be almost straight A, because we've given more people opportunity, and that's causes competition, which means you get up, it sets the bar higher, and it makes the school better. So it's a win-win-win. So I am with you. I do not know why more states don't do that with their lottery money.
I just don't understand. I really don't. And another thing I wanted to bring up is when Laura was talking about, you know, wages and everything, outsourcing our work. So many people in this country, I mean, she was talking about they were turning away men from shelters. There's kids in our country alone that are going hungry. I mean, I've worked ever since I was 14 when I was able to get my papers, my work papers, and I went to work, you know, and it was a McDonald's, you know, and I brought home, you know, money and I gave it to my mom, you know, and I just don't see, like, I just wanted to just say outsourcing our work to other countries is really crippling us. I think it is. I think a lot of jobs are being taken from other countries. Like every time if it's a bill collector calling you, okay, or somebody that's calling you, or they're trying to sell you something on the phone, I can't understand what they're talking about. They're from India. And I'm saying, excuse me, who? And they can't even say my name. Or I don't understand what they're saying. It's outsourcing. They're taking the jobs away from people that really can use the jobs in this country, and they're outsourcing them out.
Totally agree on that. I tell you what, since you were addressing that, Laura, I'm gonna open your mic back up since you have been called out now on a couple of occasions. Although Julia is obviously agreeing with you, I don't know if you want to add anything.
Well, I don't know if everybody knows this or not, but I learned it because I was on unemployment at the time, and I was really shocked. During President Bush's, one of his two terms, he actually granted tax incentives for American companies to ship jobs overseas.
Okay, so I'm going to have to ask you to source that for me. And I only say that for a couple reasons. One is that the only people that can mess with the tax code is Congress. So I'm not so sure that President Bush, I mean, he doesn't have the ability to set tax rates. So I'm not sure. If there's any way we can come up with a link for that story, I would absolutely love to read it, because I don't know why he would possibly do that. That makes no sense.
Well, that was exactly what I thought. And I didn't say President Bush did it. I said it happened while he was president.
Ah, okay, my bad. I'm sorry.
And it was on the unemployment website at the time, because those people got longer unemployment and special training funds were available for them under those circumstances if their job had been outsourced. That's how I found about it. I wasn't on a news site or anything. It was actually on the site of my unemployment when I filed.
Wow. Okay. Well, So kind of a good news, bad news, right? Bad news is your job's been outsourced. Good news is at least we'll help you get trained so that we can help you get another job. You're absolutely right. And I tell you, I normally get furious with it, but there was one instance of outsourcing that I actually had to laugh. It was right after Goldman Sachs got bailed out, you know, by us, the people on this radio show and people listening to this radio show and all the other middle-class people. After we bailed them out and paid their bonuses, their executive bonuses, 1,000 of them got laid off, and their jobs were shipped over to Singapore.
Oh, really?
And I had to laugh. I'm like, normally I'd be angry, but I'm like, you know what? You had that coming.
Well, sometimes there's a little poetic justice, isn't there?
Okay, well, it looks like Debbie Lynn's gonna chase after that story.
Yes.
We do have another caller in queue.
Dan, once in a while, if you kind of got a break, read something from the chat room.
I have to tell you, I usually let Debbie Lynn do that, since she usually does that for me. But she's busy eating pizza, so I guess I'm. Yeah, Biz Tutor Magic, I'm not sure who you are, but thank you for your verbose chatness. And I see Chad usually fields for me as well. I mean, I got lots of help on this show. It's wonderful because I'm just a rookie. I'm not as expert as some of these guys who've been doing it for years. Okay, Biz Tutor Magic says, Dan, he did push for those incentives, and the tobacco companies were among the first to set up shop elsewhere. Okay, I guess I'm looking for the logic behind it, because even when they do things that are that silly, there's usually some kind of reason. Might be crazy, but there's usually some kind of like logic behind it.
Yes, to put more money in their pocket. That's what it is.
So basically you're saying is that like lobbyists paid them to incent the offshoring of jobs.
I would imagine so, yeah. There's something in there. I also read an article about should the Supreme Court pay for their own insurance, you know, health insurance, and should they be paying for their health, for their health insurance?
Okay.
My God, I mean, they get paid until they die. You know, I mean, they get paid like, it's just unbelievable the amount of money a year that they get. And rightfully, I mean, not rightfully so, but they get a lot of money, and then they want health care. Also, they don't want to pay for their health care. They don't want to pay for their assistance, health care. And people here can't even get a pair of glasses. I can't even get a pair of glasses. You know, I mean, honestly, I don't have $200 to put out, you know, for a pair of glasses. I mean, to go see a doctor, it's unbelievable just to walk in there. I just don't understand. I really don't understand this country. It really is. It's a rich man's, you know, it's a rich man's or a rich woman's world, you know, and the poor goes to the curb. You get people that don't even have a car or anything going down, trying to get some kind of assistance, all right, in the rain, okay, waiting for buses, in the rain. Older people, I'm not talking about younger ones, I'm talking about olders, people that, like, lost their jobs due to the storm in Jersey, okay, that lost their jobs, lost their homes, lost everything, and are still, went through this whole winter, okay, with no heat in the house, mold. You should come up here and just take a look, all right? I mean, Christy is trying to do his best, and he's pushing, you know, He's pushing these buttons, and these people do not. And I have to say, Christie doesn't take any shit, you know? But, I mean, he's only one man. He's only one man. And I don't know what to do about it, but there's a lot of money going to be lost down the shore, revenue, whatever. And I just feel bad for the people that, you know, I am blessed. I have, you know, a warm place to live, a roof over my head, and I have yogurt in my refrigerator. You know, and people don't even have that. Don't have the luxury of that. It's not over. I mean, it really isn't. I mean, FEMA came in when Katrina, and, you know, went in and fixed it up. And, okay, it's not all the way there, but, I mean, it's not cold there. We had, like, in Jersey, 14-plus inches of snow. It's been cold, you know. I can't even turn up my thermostat up past 65 because my gas bill is so high. And I'm not complaining about it because there's other people that don't have a thermostat to put up the heat, you know, or having money coming in. You know, I feel sorry for those people. I feel sorry for the people that are still homeless and out in Long Island and out, you know, destroyed, absolutely destroyed. You haven't been here to see what was done. I mean, roofs of homes were peeled back like a can opener, can being opened. I mean, there's people out there that don't have things to eat. I mean, I try my best. I don't have much money, but there's a sweatshirt place, and it's Save Our Shores, Jersey Shores, and not Jersey Shores, the TV show, but it's like Restore Our Shores.
Right.
And it says on the sweatshirts, you could get T-shirts and stuff like that. Now, these guys are taking just the money that it costs just for the shirt alone, all right? And they are printing out and then sending they're taking the money and giving, like, cards out, like, to, like, A&P, whatever, and grocery stores, other places out to eat because they don't even have stuff to cook. They don't have electricity still, you know.
It's a total shame that it's what's happening there. And then when you see what, you know, the games that were played with that whole relief bill, you know, where people are trying to sneak pork in here and pork in there, and then getting all offended when people are saying, well, why are you trying to put pork in this bill? This has nothing to do with the relief. You know, it's sickening. It's absolutely sickening. We as the people are going to have to take this back because I don't think in the near term, or maybe not even in the long term, that people in Washington are going to change. They're because they're doing just fine, right? You know?
We need to
take it back. So I think you're on the right track. I applaud your compassion and you're exemplary of the middle class. You know, the people that have struggled and continue to struggle, and yet we give more on a per capita basis back in charitable contributions than the rich do. So they just haven't walked a mile in somebody's shoes, or they haven't walked a mile without shoes because the guy doesn't have any shoes, right?
Exactly. He has, you know what he has on his feet? He has plastic bottles.
Yeah. Well,
you know?
All right. Well, we're going to keep on keeping on and try to figure this one out, Julie. Again, really appreciate you calling in. I am going to go to one of our regulars and one of my absolute favorites, Mr. Goldman from Kansas. Jack, how are you this evening?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is me.
This is you. I think everybody in Coffee Party knows exactly who you are, Jack. I think you're absolutely you call into every show. You always have great comments, and I think you're a household. I think you could run for office and win.
Well, I don't have that ambition. I'm over in my 80s, and I'm gonna do something good for our country, and. I want to come to a different subject. I think the whole damn problem is partisanship. Okay, I lived in California for 39 years. And 1 year, we actually had an open primary where you could vote, regardless of party, you could vote for a Democrat, a Republican, you know, maybe had umpteen candidates running for office, for governor, let's say. And I think if this were to try that, I think we should push for that. Open
okay.
Primaries.
Oh, okay, open primaries, right. Get this two-party system, shake that out, get more points of view. I mean, certainly if we like transpartisanship and if people think transpartisanship is a good idea, which means bringing all viewpoints to the table, certainly there has to be more than two, right? Imagine if all you went to, if you went to the ice cream store and all you had to choose from was vanilla or chocolate.
Yeah, that's right.
it just doesn't make sense.
And I don't care for vanilla. It's plain vanilla.
So you're sticking with chocolate there.
Chocolate or strawberry or pistachio or whatever, yeah.
Well, there you go. See, there's your third and your fourth party.
One solution. And I think they stopped the bickering. As far as taxes go, that's another thing. We revised the tax code. I heard something that back in 1916, when the income tax first came out, there was only 15 pages of the whole code. We can get that down to 100 pages, our whole damn tax code. I think this will simplify it, and I think. I know I'm one that hates special interests, and then do away with all exemptions, credits, and deductions, and filing status, and carried interest is kaput. You should tax ordinary income. You can tax the carried interest and all that stuff, interest, dividends, as ordinary income.
I'm so with you on that one. Capital gains, capital gains.
Capital
income
gains
is income, and however you make your money. Yep, I agree. Hey, Jack, let me ask you a question. I take a guess. You said that it was 15 pages when it was first written. Guess how many – do you know how many pages the actual tax code is today? You want to take a guess?
It's about 70,000. 70,
very good, sir. 71,684 pages. Yeah. And all generated by your friends, the special interests, so that they can create their loopholes – and they can shelter their money offshore, and they can have their way and not pay their fair share.
And that's one thing they can do. But I don't know, just afraid to let's say, do away with offshore shelters like the Cayman Islands and Switzerland and just hate doing. They just don't want to do that, save money, and we can have that debt down to nothing in 10 years and not hurt the average guy. And I don't think we should mess with cutting Social Security benefits or Medicare benefits or Medicaid. A few Republicans that actually are going to go with the Medicaid, like Brewer of Arizona.
Yeah, and that's really the whole
and,
kind of the whole topic. The whole idea of this show is exactly that, Jack. You've hit the nail on the head. It's the people that have. I've made mine. It's like, well, forget everybody else. If I don't need Medicare, then why should Medicare exist? And why should I pay into Medicare? You know, why should my tax money go for that? It's the same kind of idea that sometimes people you'll find in communities that when they want to vote for a higher school tax, they say, well, but all my children are grown and gone, so I don't have kids going to that school, so why should I pay more taxes? It's this whole idea of me, what's best for me, and not thinking about the community. And it's just very frustrating, isn't it?
Well, if I could do something in Kansas, right where I am in Hugoton, Kansas, but I do have Facebook friends in Kansas, but they don't get together. I have a lot of Facebook friends in California and Chicago, where I'm originally from, and what other place? Florida, all over the United States.
Well, we have to connect somehow, and the distance is obviously makes it hard.
The solution would be to have an old-fashioned brainstorming session. I don't know where you can get maybe 100 people to meet somewhere in the center. It could be Kansas, it could be California, it could be New York. I don't know. Yeah. And just brainstorm these whole problems. I think it's all done. You can get it all done that way.
I like it. It's a very coffee party idea, Jack. I think it's a wonderful idea.
Yeah.
Hey Jack, a quick question for you. Where in Kansas are you?
Hugoton. That's in the southwest corner.
Well, I just have to ask you a personal question. I know the southwest corner because my grandmother was born in Morton County.
No, I'm just talking to somebody.
Patty?
No.
Oh, Patty.
No. No, not Patty.
All
okay.
Right, Jack. Well, I'll let you go, Jack.
Thank
but my my family, my on my mother's side, my family's from Morton County, Kansas, so we have some commonalities there.
Oh yeah, that's right in the southwest corner.
Yes, it is.
Yep, and you and I have commonality, Jack, because I was born and raised in Chicago, so we're both Chicagoans.
Oh yeah.
So always a pleasure talking to you, Jack. Thanks very much.
Bye bye.
Calling anytime. That is Jack Golding from Kansas. Love that man. He's awesome. We've got it looks like I'm guessing it's a Skype caller who's calling in from 111111111111. Who do I have the pleasure of speaking with?
Yes, hi. How are you? Are you speaking to me?
Yes, sir, I am.
Yeah, this is Mr. Solution. I was just perusing the websites here, and I saw your topic, which seems fairly interesting. What should the rich give back?
Well, it's kind of a two-part question, but just before I get there, you said this is Mr. Solution?
Correct.
Oh, I love your moniker. That's a beautiful thing. I am with you. I walk in your wake, sir, because there's a lot of people that complain about things and nobody ever wants, but then they never offer a solution. So I already like you. Can you tell me where you're calling from?
That was the idea. L.A., where are you located?
Beautiful. So I live in Portland, Oregon, as does my co-host, but I'm actually broadcasting tonight from Tampa, Florida, where I'm out here on a business trip.
Oh, great. The miracle of technology. Look here, I was particularly interested and amused by the pictorial depictions you have here, the flashing, particularly the guy with all the money in his arms. Now, is he considered rich? We don't know the denomination of those bills, but would you say this guy is rich?
Well, that's what he's supposed to represent, yes.
Okay, all right. And, of course, yours that says filthy rich, I particularly like that. This is a great philosophical and social question, and it is I wrote a paper in graduate school dealing with race, class, and gender, and wealth is usually polarized around the intersection of the overlap or the intersection of those particular concepts or descriptions. And what do you think about that now that you hear it?
So I definitely agree, but with the caveat that I think that people – I think it depends on how you perceive your own situation, right? John Steinbeck, the great author from the Depression era, said – he had a great quote, and I'm not going to quote it exactly. I'm going to mess it up, but he said – the difference between poor people and poor Americans is that poor Americans all envision themselves as temporarily down in their luck millionaires.
No,
I mean, because when you look at the economic divide, the inequality in our country now, which is huge and growing, right? You have to sit there and scratch your heads as to how many of these people are hurting. He actually voted for the Republicans this year. How is that possible? People that are saying we're going to cut your benefits, we're going to put austerity measures in, we're going to cut Medicaid, we're going to cut Medicare, we're going to cut Social Security. I mean, they're telling you straight to your face, I'm going to. And by the way, I'm going to continue subsidies for oil companies and people that are already filthy rich. And it's like, stop. And then they vote for him anyway. I don't get it. What's the Mr. Solution? Tell me what the disconnect is in these people's heads, and how do we fix it?
Well, endeavoring to live up to my namesake. Look, I think that the answer is not behind that door. I don't know if you've read Robert Kiyosaki, and there are others, but he touches on some points of profundity. And that is that financial intelligence is really not taught in school. That is something that has to be learned pretty much in the family or extra school, outside of school.
So, this is where you get into the what is intelligence versus what is common sense, right?
Well,
No.
No. You're misconstruing what I'm saying. Financial intelligence is a unique type of intelligence. It's not like other types of intelligence, according to Mr.
Oop, Mr. Solutions, did we lose you?
No, I'm here.
Okay, I'm sorry. You cut out there for a second, or I did. One of us cut out.
Sure.
So I'm sorry.
I was just saying that according to Mr. Kiyosaki, financial intelligence is unique. It is unique in its essence. It's like any other type of intelligence, and it is an acquired intelligence. But what I would think is, number one, you were talking about the tax code, and, you know, obviously we could talk about that for hours, but inflation is, instituted by government, and it's instituted to diminish one's wealth. And it's done in a very furtive fashion, but it's done nonetheless. If you talk about the inflation rate, That basically means savers or losers. There?
Yeah, no, I'm there. I you had me up until that last part of inflation favors the losers.
No. Well, savers are losers as a result of inflation.
Savers are losers. Okay, I thought you said favors. Like, it, yeah, okay, it's yes, right. Exactly. You're exactly correct.
Yeah, because even though they may have the same dollar denomination, those dollars are able to purchase less than they did, say, for example, the year before. But at any rate, you know, again, finances is a very, very important subject because I say one success, you know, after they get out of school. In school, your success is measured on your performance of receiving good grades. In life, it's pretty much based upon the wealth that one accumulates. And I think I always enjoy reading articles about wealth. And it is very individualistic. But I think asset-debt ratio is the best indicator of wealth. What would you say?
Well, that's right. So that's basically net worth.
Right.
Right. No, I totally agree. Right. I mean, if you can have lots of money, but if you have lots of debt, that doesn't really do you much good.
Right. Right.
So,
if you make a million and spend a million, you're still broke.
Yeah. Absolutely. I actually was in a senior level finance course, not a finance course, but a senior level marketing course, and they had an entrepreneur come in from the local economy, and he bragged about how he had done $1 million in sales, and that's all he kept referring to. And I said, during the Q&A, I said, excuse me, but what was your profit on that $1 million in sales? And he said, well, that's not important, because the big goal was to get $1 million in sales. And I was like, well, I'm pretty sure if I get $2 million in single dollar bills that I can stand on the street corner and sell them for 50 cents and I can make $1 million in sales too, but I don't think that's a really good business model. And I was asked to leave immediately from that class. But yeah,
some very dastardly things have been done. And I guess, you know, I try to truncate things, make them real concise. And I guess the only thing is to talk about wealth and to look at what one needs reasonably, acquire that much wealth, and anything in excess, one can, of course, invest it in an offshore account. Now, that's a joke, but it's actually realistic, though. But I think that in America, you know, wealth is never really adequately defined, so people are confused about it. And I think that creates a problem of achievement. You know, what is it? Because I think most people in America, we live off of debt, actually. Everything is pretty much debt finance. And you found that out when there was the real estate crash roughly of 2008, where people, they were using their home equity as an ATM. And when the housing market collapsed, you saw people go into panic, because their wealth source had dried up.
Yeah. So here's the thing. So again, it's two parts to it. So we have people that have made that are wealthy, and regardless of how you define it, you know, the top 1-2% of the wealth holders in this country are, let's just call them, like, ridiculously wealthy, right? So the question is, as an American, do those people have some kind of obligation to give back, either as individuals or as corporate, let's call it corporate citizens, the corporations, since apparently, according to Citizens United, they have a lot of rights that people do. Do they have an obligation as Americans, as being part of our society, to give back?
Well, it probably should be volitional for the most part. And, I mean, in a free society, where people are given the right to, you know, pursue their economic capability to its limits, I don't know that we need – I don't like this class warfare. Excuse me. I think that creates more problems than anything else. But I think it's a subject that we should constantly discuss. And I think more importantly are the prerequisite morals that surround money. You know, if you watched any of the movies dealing with Wall Street, it's talking greed is good and this kind of thing. So I just think, you know, we need to talk about it. But, you know, this idea of socialism, you know, taking what other people have and appropriating it to the less, how should I say, the people who are less motivated to actually pursue wealth, you know, that's a problem. And oftentimes when we do, you know, the average income is what, right at $50,000, maybe a little bit less, $51,000. And we usually focus on the extremely wealthy. And I think that could be a mistake. But in any event, I think we need to look at, like I say, the morals surrounding money and discussing the issue. Because I think when people are very successful and they don't feel threatened, they will give to, you know, causes that interest them.
You know, okay. I gotta jump in here for just a second here because, you know, There are generous people in all aspects of our society, you know, from being impoverished to who are giving the shirt off their back to the very wealthy like the Warren Buffetts and the Bill Gates. And so they're, you know, regardless, you know, you're talking about the class warfare and I like to talk about the 100% instead of the 99% because we are all on this together. So I understand what you're saying there. At the same time, our system is set up right now where it's not a fair playing field, where the bankers have written the rules to favor them to the disadvantage of people who don't have access to capital. And that's something that, you know, no matter how hard some people try to get ahead, how much they play by the rules and do everything they're supposed to do, our system is set up to be corrupt. And that in and of itself is, you know, it's not a level playing field. And I'm just fighting for fairness here. And, you know, I have plenty of willingness to work. I'm just speaking for me personally right now. I have plenty of willingness to work. I've had the six-figure income. And in today's culture and society, there are not as many opportunities for me as there were 10 years ago because of our system. And it's not that I'm not looking. It's not that I don't have desire. It's not that I'm not willing to work.
Well, Mr. Solution, we still with you? You still with us?
Well, yeah, I was going to allow you to. I was graciously allowing you to field that one.
Oh, well, no. It's my pleasure. It gets back to the same question I was asking, and that is there an obligation? And I'll tell you where I think the I say yes, but let me tell you why I think it. It's not necessarily a matter of American or patriotism or that whatnot. To me, it's all about the fact that in the 1980s, we were introduced to trickle-down economics, and the whole idea was we will tilt the playing field towards the corporations and the wealthy. We will allow them to accumulate great amounts of wealth, which they very successfully did. But the idea was that it was supposed to trickle down, right? And I get that the income of the top earners is well above and accelerates at a bigger pace of regular household earners. But the middle class income has gone up approximately 22% since the 1960s, whereas the top 1% earners have gone up 290%. And there's the inequity that we see in this country, and I don't know if you're familiar with Joseph Stiglitz and his book, The Price of Inequity, but the inequity and the growing inequity of this country is threatening to, well, it's gutting the middle class. And it's, you know, we've got 1.6 million people who were in 2008 working mid-wage jobs and now working are underemployed, like Debbie Lynn, that are lucky to, you know, get a job at a fast food restaurant. And we've got new kids and new college graduates coming into a broken marketplace that doesn't offer a lot of opportunity. The average, I read the other day, the average age now of, it's like 60% of 34-year-olds and below are still living at home. Because they can't, there's no jobs out there for them. So it just seems to me that these people are, there was a contract to me. Trickle-down economics was a contract. They have not lived up to their side of the bargain. They got theirs.
Yeah. I like I say again, this is a phenomenal subject, and I think, you know, industry is indispensable for individualistic growth. But I just think that there's not enough understanding of money dynamics, or on the part of the general public, or money trajectory. And I think that's a big part of the problem. And actually, I know a portion of the solution, and the solution, like I would say, good books, again, like Robert's book, Robert Kiyosaki. Of course, I've read The Millionaire Next Door, Think and Grow Rich, and a number of other books. Now, some people see that as just, marketing hype, but I don't. I think it's very important. I believe Copernicus wrote an article on money, and it's how it's depreciated by government. Like, if you would ask the average person, you would say, well, what is inflation? They don't know. That's very, very important to know what inflation is, because if you don't know what it is, you can't avoid it. I mean, one ends up being ensnared by it. So while the problems you mention are obviously they're huge problems, and they're something, you know, a nation has to get a hold on, because when we're dealing with macro and microeconomics, that certainly falls within that context. But I think a basic and fundamental understanding of money, as opposed to being debt-financed. I think debt, I don't know if you guys are familiar with, I'm sure you probably are, the national debt clock. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, you see that now we owe more money than is in the world. And, you know, hyperbolic, but I think it's close to being, go ahead.
The whole thing about our monetary system, is that it's all fiat money anyway. And as soon as we stop believing in it, the whole thing's going to collapse. It's all based on nothing. It's air.
Well, I don't know if it's quite nothing, and I don't. You know, you understand the concept of hegemony or economic hegemony, which the U.S. has. And I think a lot of work is going to have to take place in the minds of individuals. But I do think that financial intelligence is going to be crucial going forward. Was it Einstein that said, the understanding the phenomena of compound interest, is a benefit to that to the one who understands it, and the one who doesn't has to pay it.
And usury used to be considered one of the seven deadly sins.
Right, but
and
now it's
compound interest. Compound interest is just a form of usury.
Yeah, but now it's commonplace, correct? With the credit cards
That doesn't mean it's not usury. It just means that we've become desensitized to it. But it's still usury.
No, I agree with you. But again, that goes back to individuals' personal financial intelligence, because I think we have to work on a two-tier level at minimum, and that is on a national level and on an individualistic level. because according to my calculations and observations, most Americans have been living off of debt. They've been living beyond their means. Would you agree with that?
Probably about half of us, but not all of us, yeah.
And I would add in that that many of those who are living off debt were sold a bill of goods to say, it's okay, keep going into debt because
yeah.
Look, your house price is going to go up and everything's going to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to it's all good. And there's so much predatory lending that went on in the home buying industry and then in the credit card industry. And again, no one went to jail. No, you know, people, some banks paid fines, but it was dropping the bucket money. And you're right. I totally agree with you that it would be great if we could somehow, you know, get people more educated on money. But I think the real impetus for doing so is because the people on Wall Street are using their ignorance against them, and they know it, and they're taking advantage.
And then there's the whole advertising marketing industry, don't forget, in our consumer economy. I mean, the whole thing is based upon this.
Well, look here, you guys have a great show. I'm going to see you again. I have another appointment or engagement, so you guys have a great, great evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Solution. Come call anytime.
Sure.
All right. I almost feel like I was watching one of those wrestling shows where the mystery man comes out in the mask and he's Mr. now entering the ring, Mr. Solution. I love it. It's a beautiful thing. Actually, we were getting a little bit of background intelligence on Mr. Solution. I think somebody mentioned that he was actually a regular contributor to MSNBC, and we may have had a mystery celebrity in our presence, but that was very cool.
Who knows?
That was very cool. I'm going to open Laura's mic back up because I think she might have cycled again. I'm guessing Laura probably wanted a piece of Mr. Solution. I was going to give you that opportunity, Laura, but then he decided to leave.
He bailed.
Yeah. So, Laura, did you have something for us?
Oh, okay. I didn't hear unmute, so I wasn't sure.
Sorry.
Sometimes I hear it and sometimes I don't. I don't know why. Yeah, I just wanted to say two quick things. Number one, getting back to your point of selfishness, I actually said that to somebody I worked with who used to be, believe it or not, I forgot the title. He worked with youth in the church. And he said, I homeschool my kids. Why should I pay for somebody else's kids? And I said, I was an abused child that got taken away from my parents, okay, when I was young. Would you rather I be a criminal or would you rather I've been educated and be here working with you?
And
number
what
two.
Was what was the response?
That's
amazing. That's an amazing statement to make. What was his response?
I think he was tongue-tied. I just think he never knew people like that existed. Most of us don't mention it. We don't want to talk about it to people because we know people don't want to hear it. They don't want to know it.
Yeah. Well, and again, you know, I'm sure that person is a fine libertarian. I studied the libertarian movement and I kind of understand the pull of it. Right. But
yeah.
I also don't understand how we live in a society, we live in cities, you know, we don't live in compounds in, you know, rural Montana that are self-sufficient. That's not how our society is set up. Our society is set up to be cooperative in nature. And you know, one of the things that people always say is, well, we should start cooperatives. I'm like, well, that's what we did. It's called government. It's supposed to be doing that. We shouldn't need to start cooperative. So we all decided we'll pitch in on sewer systems and we'll pitch in on schools and we'll pitch in because it's things that make the society better as a whole. And then it's like in the 80s, again, the go-go 80s, it turned around to be like, forget that. I'm going to get mine.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's one of the reasons why infrastructure spending has slowed so much is because we've become this society of, you know, I'll take care of my own, you take care of your own, and that's it. When did, you know, we got to reverse that trend. We have to find a way to reverse that trend.
Dan, we'll have to see how other people's lives interconnect with theirs. But I wanted to say two other things real quick, okay?
Then you
go on a tangent. Number one, I was at the pharmacy, and I said to the pharmacist, do you know how much money you're allowed to have if you're going to have Medicaid? $600 a month. That's in this state. It's different in every state, okay? In this state, it's $600 a month. Now, if you make $700 and you're on Medicaid, that $100 extra must be spent on your medical care before they will start paying for it. So you are not allowed to have more than $600 a month. Now, her response to me was, you got to cut it off somewhere.
Yeah, right. That's austerity talk, which is, of course, ridiculous. I mean,
well, you know how much money pharmacists make?
Yes. And,
yeah, not quite
and,
as much
but,
as
but, doctors. But forget the pharmacist law. It's the insane profitability of drug companies, of big pharma. It's insanity, the profits that those companies make.
Well, no, that wasn't my point, Dan. $600 a month, do you really think there are many places in the United States where you can actually feed yourself, go to work, and put a roof over your head for $600 a month?
Ah, I see what you're saying. Yes, no, that you're right. That is a ridiculously small amount.
But it's all about
not paying the benefit, right? It's all about, well, we don't have any money left, so we have to keep lowering it. My point, Laura, on the pharmacy was that when President Bush got his drug extensions on the drug benefits of Medicare and Medicaid pushed through, there was a little clause in there that said, you have to buy from the United States companies, and you can't negotiate price even.
Yeah.
It was actually in there. And think if we could actually start getting our drugs from Canada or from India, from wherever, as long as the FDA says they're safe, then how much more benefit could we give to everybody?
Well, why is something safe in Europe and not safe in the U.S.? You know, I mean, you got to think about that. You really do have to think about that.
I honestly don't believe I'm saying this myself. I kind of trust the FDA.
I work for pharma. Sorry.
Okay.
And I worked around one chemist who used to work for the FDA. No, their noses aren't as clean as you'd like to think they are.
But if they're being paid off by pharma, then wouldn't it be in their best interest to actually be easier on those companies and not take 4 years for the clinical trials to push a drug to say a drug's okay?
Well, I'm not saying there's not good and bad, but, you know, if you look like you're all bad, we're all going to know you're bad. But if you can look mostly good and not let people know about the bad stuff, I'll give you an example. The way you run a clinical trial, you can cherry pick your patients.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. No doubt you can make the data look exactly like you want it to. I agree.
Okay. And the last thing I wanted to say is I am so tired, so tired, Dan, of hearing people talk about, my grandfather came over here with nothing. Well, if he had nothing, how the hell did he get over here?
Somebody reached back and helped him out.
You know, there used to be, like, really bad punishments for, what do they call it, when you sneak on a ship and hide, you didn't pay for your ticket?
No way.
Yeah. I mean, they used to really punish those people. So I'm assuming somehow it was paid for. And if you had absolutely nothing, where did you live and how did you eat until you got some money?
Right. And it goes back to the top of the show. And historically speaking, somebody came over on a shoestring, got a job, and saved up money, and then sent passage money for passage back. You know, and if you go back and look at some of the old ads for like crossings, like what it cost you to cross, it wasn't like you could get in steerage class for $25, which back then was a fortune, of course, right? But then when you got there, people formed societies, right? So, and usually it was centered around nationality. So there was the Irish society and there was the Italian society. And they took people in and they took care of them and they set them up with employment. And that's what I mean. It's like, when did that just go away? When did this concept of I've made it and now I'm going to reach back and I'm going to help somebody else, when did that just disappear?
I think it happened over time, slowly eroded, very slow. Changes come in, they're very insidious because they make them look like something good when they're really not. It reminds me of the devil, you know, in the story that a lot of people like to talk about in the Old Testament about Adam and Eve. And the serpent said to Eve, surely you will not die. You will be as knowledgeable as God. You will be like God. See, this shiny, beautiful apple, it's going to give you things you never dreamed of.
Oh yeah, I hear you. Hey, Laura, guess what? With 20 minutes left in the show, we've actually got two new callers.
Okay.
So you mind if I get to them?
No.
All right, thank you, ma'am. All right, we're going to Piston Pilot, and I don't know, maybe from the Motor City. Piston Pilot, you're on the air.
No, I go by the One Angry Jew.
Oh, okay.
You know of me?
I know of your legend, sir, yes.
Two things I noticed when I popped onto the show. I thought Don might have made an appearance back. I've been trying to get him to do that. But I don't understand the thing at the top where it says, what should the rich give back? Did they take something that wasn't theirs?
They were given something that they would not have had if it wasn't for the rules being changed in their favor. And it was openly done. Openly done.
So guy that makes it and takes care of his family, makes a few million dollars, he was given something how?
So trickle-down economics. The deregulation of Wall Street, the deregulation of industry, the lowering of the capital gains tax.
I'm not going to argue with you that the bankers and the Wall Street people are not all scum. Most of them are. I think the bankers have ruined this country. But the bankers have ruined this country with the complete AOK of the people in Congress, Democrat and Republican.
Absolutely.
They have been given carte blanche to rape and pillage the American people. The two presidents that tried to create real money, which is, I don't know if you've ever seen real money, it's called a United States note. You ever seen one?
I have seen, maybe in the Smithsonian.
I've got one right in front of me. I have one here. I have two of them. And the two presidents that tried to bring them back were both shot and killed. Kennedy and Lincoln.
Okay.
And the United States note says that it's backed not by fiat, it's backed by the Treasury of the United States of America. It's got a red seal, not a green seal. It doesn't say Federal Reserve note on it. So somebody who's figured out a way to make money in this climate, or even 30 years ago or 100 years ago, why would they have to give something back?
Well, that was the question. So that was the question. The question was, do they have an obligation? I'm not saying that I know the answer. I ask people to call in and tell me what they think. Do you think they have an obligation to give back?
No, I don't. The woman that was just on, I picked up on her. I heard that incredulous comment that she made. She said, do you know what pharmacists make? Well, I happen to know what pharmacists make because I dated one for 8 years. Sat with her through school. She's a doctor of pharmacy. I sat with her for many years while she studied to become that pharmacist. Do you know what they make? People make what they bring to the workforce, to the table. What are they worth? Somebody who has a degree and knowledge of pharmacy and pharmacology should make more money than other people. They spent years in school learning their craft. Why wouldn't they make more? And I know how much they make. They start out at about $105,000 a year working for Walmart or any of the drugstore chains. And they're hard to find. A pharmacist is not easy. You can't just pluck them out of anywhere. And the
right.
day that
no,
they,
no,
the day that,
I hear you,
and
I
let me finish.
Right,
the day
ahead,
that they save your life, the day they save your life by catching a drug interaction, or by hearing you say something as they're handing you over the medicine. See, most people don't give pharmacists a good shake. They don't talk to the pharmacist. They just sign away and say, "Yeah, I sign away my that I've been counseled. I waive that. I don't want to talk to these pharmacists. I'd rather hear from the doctors." Got news for you. The doctors don't know crap about the drugs that they push. They know more about the pretty girls that come in with long legs and nice-looking pantsuits and dresses that come in and tell them all about the drugs they should push, the expensive drugs. When I take my five-year-old for antibiotics, the doctors are always pushing a $200 dose of drugs. When guess what? The $10 dose works great. You want to pay pilots?
You know,
you want to pay pilots less money? Pilots.
You know,
a pilot will show you what he's worth when everything goes to hell, and they get yourself out of a disaster. That's when that's when they show
well,
you what they're
right,
worth.
Right, right, but hold on a second. I think Debbie Lamont wants to chime in here.
Well, I mean, there's just so many like sexist comments in there. I just am having a little reaction here because you know.
Is it a bad reaction?
Several...
I have a cream you could rub on that if it's a bad reaction.
Oh, that's...
Oh, thank you there, real one. I so appreciate that. I mean, so many doctors I go to see are married women, and so, you know, your long-leg comment was just like, oh, my God, where is this guy from?
I have no doubt that they send good-looking guys. I have no doubt that the drug reps that take care of the women doctors are GQ-looking men.
But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I understand what you're saying, that you're trying to say the pharmaceutical companies are using sex to sell their drugs.
Absolutely.
The same way that the car companies use sex to sell their cars to consumers. I got it.
Well, that's fine, but I don't need the newer antibiotic that has all sorts of untested and unknown side effects when the $10 antibiotic that has been around for 40 years is
that the telling us has been that now there's a lot of resistance to.
And most
so
people
anyway.
Don't even understand that concept. You've heard that they say, well, the doctor shouldn't give you prescriptions for antibiotics. You don't become resistant to an antibiotic by taking an antibiotic. You become resistant to the antibiotic by taking it and stopping it before the course is over. Because an antibiotic, when it starts taking effect, and an antibiotic does nothing more than help your own body fight the bacteria. It doesn't have any magical potions. It just makes your body get out of the way so it can fight it. But when the antibiotic takes effect, it hasn't killed off the bacteria. It's just beat it back so it's not bothering you as much. Since people... when they start to feel better, they stop taking the rest of the antibiotics. And then the bacteria becomes stronger because it's not been killed. It's been played with a little bit, and it becomes resistant to the antibiotic because
so
it was
original,
never killed off.
So the original question here was about what to, you know, is there something that wealthy Americans should be giving back to America, and what does it mean to be
American?
Well,
maybe we should define what a wealthy American is, first of all, because I don't think I heard that.
Well, let's just, I don't think we need to do that if we just talk about it is in proportion. Because, again, I mean, the one thing we know is that the middle class on a per capita basis gives away way more charity than the rich people do, and on per capita and as well as a percentage of their total income. So I don't think we have to get into those details. I think you've answered the question, which was no. There's no obligation whatsoever. I've made it. It's my money. If I want to give it, I'll give it. If I don't want
to
give
it, I won't.
Well, it
sounds like it assumes that they took something that wasn't theirs.
Well, I thought I laid out that.
This goes back to the pharmacist comment. If my ex-girlfriend...
Well, hold on a second.
She spent time learning pharmacy. She deserves the reward, doesn't she?
I don't mean to speak for Laura, but first of all, there's 10 minutes left, and I've got actually two callers on hold, and I really, really wish you had called earlier.
I'm your more interesting caller by far. you don't want to get rid of me.
But I don't. I want to go on for another hour after this, but I think Laura's comment was not that she didn't deserve to make their money. Laura's comment was that she felt that this woman, who was a highly paid professional, was just being insensitive to the plight of lesser fortunate people. I think that was her problem, that there was no empathy. You know, this woman not only didn't feel the need to give back, but she said she didn't feel the need to be empathetic. So I think that's what rubbed Laura the wrong way. She wasn't saying that this woman didn't deserve her money. She's just saying that here's a person who's made it who doesn't even care to give me a little sympathy about my plight. So I think that was the gist of her comment.
Okay. Yeah, I wish we did have an hour. I would certainly be able to fill that hour with a good banter back and forth. And keep you on your toes where you should.
I appreciate that. Come back. Promise they'll come back next Monday. And
you wish for.
Oh no, I wish. Like I said, I've heard they warn me about you, and I said, bring it on. I love it. I love it. I love it. So I'm going to try to get these last two callers. Please call back next Monday, and I really appreciate you calling in.
Okay.
All right. 210. We're going to area code 210. Who do I have the pleasure of speaking with?
Yeah, this is Jesse Ramon from San Antonio, Texas. How you doing?
Hi, Jesse Ramon. How's the Riverwalk? I love that city.
Still as dirty as it was 30 years ago.
Yeah, that's why you go at night, so you can't see it, right?
There you go. Thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure. What do you think it means to be an American, and do you have an obligation to give back once you've made it?
Well, to shorten the conversation, I'm not going to turn this into a medical journal, but with all due respect, I know he had a good point. But the fact of the matter is that the reason that the rich are where they are today is because they've earned that right. But it doesn't give them the right to do what they want with what they've earned as well. You know, this is the fault that the people complain about the rich today is nobody's fault but ours as Americans, because we have allowed, out of ignorance, of course, we have allowed to see the not know about the things that have transpired over the last 50 years or longer. But you know, you have insider trade information. This is what people are mad about. You got insider trade information. People don't realize, but the facts are, and you could look at the statistics and they'll show it. I'm reading a book right now. God, I can't remember the name of the dead gum book. Throw them all out. There you go. Throw them all out.
I like it already.
I'm sorry?
I said I like it already.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of this guy that wrote the book. I'm so embarrassed. But he was on the Bill Maher show not too long ago. But nonetheless, 80% of all Congress, House, the Senate, that went into these offices, okay, as public servants who get a pretty good salary, they were not millionaires when they came into office, but were millionaires within 4 years after they got in. And, you know, we're not stupid. We all understand why. It's because of insider trade information, and it's because it's been allowed. You know, and then when they make their millions, they send them over to Swiss bank accounts overseas to where they can't get taxed. there's a location somewhere in the Bahamas or something that over I think they said the other night 2 million 2 million people all share the same residence just so they can hide their money. Well, not only that, but the fact of the matter is that years ago, I'm 55, I'm 100% disabled veteran, and I get a pension. Okay, I get disability pay. And I'm fortunate. I'm fortunate in that, you know. But I have to suffer with my disabilities as well. But, you know, I don't blame somebody for being a millionaire. They deserve, they worked hard to get there. Most of them, I'm sure. But the fact of the matter is look at the benefits, how they've dwindled for people who work today. You have these big pharmaceutical companies that get their way. Why? Because Congress takes care of them. And so
Well, because they take care of Congress, right?
That's right. You know, all this crookedness is going on, and that's the reason why this country is divided. I mean, I've got very close friends that are Republicans and some are Democrats. I'm an independent. Yes, I voted for President Obama. Why did I vote for President Obama? Not because he's a Democrat. Because I see him as a sincere man. Now, I'm sure he has his faults. And God knows there's been one or two or three or four things that I don't agree with. But he's for equality. And that's what Americans need to understand. I don't care what color the man is. It's because he stands for equality, and I see and I feel the sincereness in his voice. It's not because he's a Democrat.
Yeah. So Jesse, again, I don't mean to cut you off, but we've only got 3 minutes left in the show. First and foremost, I want to say thank you for your service, sir. Anybody who serves in my book is a hero. I really do appreciate it. Your service. Obviously, sorry for what happened to you. I think you've maintained, honestly, a great attitude throughout the whole thing. And you haven't got, obviously, it doesn't feel like you've gotten bitter or anything of that nature. So, if anybody, to me, gets to say what it's like to be an American, it's somebody who's defended all of our rights to be whatever American we want to be, good, bad, or otherwise. So thank you very much for that. I guess the question becomes, so how do we break the cycle of corruption? How do we do it? How do we throw them all out?
Well, it's not a matter of throwing them all out. It's a matter of us starting an investigation. You know, we need to assign a special investigative department that starts doing investigations on all those who have done wrong and who have corrupted the power that they've given, whether it's President Obama, whether it's the administration of George Bush, it doesn't matter. You know, if we don't start penalizing people, this country will never look at each other the way they should. You know, we used to be neighbors and help each other out. But nobody, I mean, I've got a neighbor who's a great guy, okay? But he thinks that the Democratic Party is the demon from hell. You know, and I've got, you know, so many neighbors here. We all do. We all have neighbors that we care about, and you know, we I'll watch your house while you're gone.
Yeah.
But you know what? We're divided. And we're divided with a lot of false information.
Yeah, Jesse, will you do me a favor? Will you please come back on another Monday night and call into the show? Because I'd love to have this conversation with you, but now we're now down to 1 minute in the show.
No, absolutely. I'm sorry. I apologize.
No. There's no reason to apologize. So in 1 minute, again, thank you, Jesse. I want to thank Laura. I want to thank Julie from New Jersey. I want to thank my introduction to Mr. One Angry Jew. Chad and the chats and everybody and Biz Tutor and everybody. It's been a great show. I've really loved it. You know, anytime you push the full 2 hours, I think it's great. So, again, my name is Dan Aronson, along with me, my co-host, Debbie Lynn Molyneux. Thank you very much for joining us. Come back next Monday. Don't forget the other shows, Tuesday at 7, 7 Eastern Time, 7 p.m. Sorry. You know what? I'm not even going to do this in 14 seconds. I will just say thank you very much. Tune into Coffee Party Radio. Go to the website, learn about the shows, and join us again next Monday.